Blog Talk Radio.
It's Monday night, which means it's the latest episode of Graphic Policy Radio, the show that mixes comics and politics. And tonight we also mix in music. This is the show for folks who wonder if Captain America even knows who the Beatles are. I say that because tonight we have this. See, there we go. I got you to laugh. So tonight we've got a special guest who will be joining us hopefully shortly. It's Vivek Tiwari, who's the writer and recently released graphic novel The Fifth Beatle, which came out from Dark Horse, and that graphic novel chronicles the life of Beatles manager Brian Epstein. So, and he was important that even Paul McCartney has dubbed him the Fifth Beatle. He really was a big reason we even know who the Beatles are. Before we get to Vivek when he joins us, as always, I am joined by my co-host Alana. How you doing?
Hey, I'm great. I'm so excited. I've been really looking forward to having Vivek on the show. When I saw the Ashcan promos for this comic, I just saw how gorgeous the art was, and I said, this is going to be the Christmas gift for all music fans for the year. And having looked at the copy in print now, I definitely think that's true.
So, while we wait for him, I've only read the digital, and I thought the digital was absolutely amazing. I actually have a print copy on its way, courtesy of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. What do you think? Yeah, they actually have, so at the end of the year, during their big fundraising, they usually have, like, autographed books and stuff like that, and I'm like, I want the book anyways. It's a good cause, absolutely. So
very
I thought that
appropriate.
Was...
Very appropriate.
Yeah, and I gave on Giving Tuesday. I did my part.
That's great.
Giving Tuesday actually is what reminded me to do this. So generally, like, what did you think of The Fifth Beatle?
I loved it. I loved it. I have such a deep personal connection to the Beatles, as so many people do, that I'm always a bit frightened and wary when there's new Beatles-related stuff that's produced. I didn't see Across the Universe, that movie by Julie Taymor. Like, I skip a ton of, I haven't seen, like, the Beatles, Cirque du Soleil, Michigas. Like, I skip a ton of Beatles-related stuff because I don't trust it to be right or to get it properly or to feel right to me. And when I heard Vivek speak at New York Comic Con and I saw the Ashcan then, I could tell from then that this was going to be amazing and this was going to get it and that I was going to feel good reading it. So this is actually one of the only Beatles. Hello?
Hey, I think we were just joined. So not to cut you off, but Vivek, is that you?
That's me. Hi.
Hey.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm sorry. I think I might be a few minutes late.
No,
that's
all right.
I was just saying that from the time that I saw the Ashcan and I heard you speak at New York Comic Con, I had the confidence that this was going to be a fantastic Beatles-related piece of art. And I'm someone who's very cynical and conservative about buying anything Beatles-related that isn't actually, like, from the Beatles' own catalog of work. So it was really, from when I heard you speak and from what I saw, I knew this was going to be fantastic, and it really is.
Thank you so much. It's I'm not sure which presentation you heard me speak at, but whichever one it was, you probably saw that this is a real labor of love for me. So I am very proud of it, and I'm very pleased that folks like you are responding so enthusiastically to it. It really is a dream come true for me. I've been working on it for close to two decades now. It is very gratifying, and I'm very excited. So thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us on the show.
Yeah. I mean, sorry we had to bump this, but it's awesome. I mean, this is like the old show that we both have looked forward to. So I think just starting off, a good thing would be you've mentioned that this has been almost two decades worth of work for you. I think let's just start with you telling people who might not be familiar about the project and what The Fifth Beatle actually is.
Sure. So The Fifth Beatle is a graphic novel and a film to follow it. Based on the life of Brian Epstein, who was the Beatles' manager. And I discovered the Brian Epstein story, as I said, about 20 years ago when I was in business school. In fact, it was literally 21 years ago, and I like dropping that number because I turned 40 this year, so I can literally say I've been working on this project for more than half my life. And I also like dropping that number because if you put it in perspective, 21 years ago, there's no Wikipedia, there's no YouTube, there are none of these online resources that we have today. And so I was a young person in business school, dreaming about working in the entertainment industries and tending to be a little academic, a little geeky, if you will. I thought if I'm going to work in those industries, I should study the lives of some of the great entertainment visionaries, thinking that Brian and the Beatles were the team that kind of wrote and then rewrote the rules of the pop music industry. That's what led me to an interest in studying the life of Brian Epstein. And as I said, there were sort of none of these online resources that we have today, and there were no books about Brian Epstein in print. In fact, I'm also very proud to say that The Fifth Beatle is the only book, graphic novel or otherwise, about Epstein that's in print.
Wow.
And so, you know, 21 years ago, I was kind of dumbfounded how there could be, you know, literally a book about John Lennon's astrologist, and I couldn't find any information about the guy that discovered and packaged and presented the band and brought them to the stardom that we know of in the Beatles today. And so this was like a mystery that I had to uncover. You know, it became a real fascination with me. And I was initially approaching it from that Beatles perspective, from, you know, wanting the Beatles business story, how he got them a record deal when no one wanted to sign them, how he came up with the suits and the haircuts, how he convinced Ed Sullivan to book them when a British band had never made an impact in the United States. Like, that was the story I was after, the sort of behind-the-scenes making of the Beatles story. And that's in the book, and it's a wonderful story, and it is an inspiring business story, and it's an inspiring Beatles story. And that was certainly a large part of what fascinated me with Brian. But it was really the human side of his story that I knew nothing about when I began this research that really deeply struck a chord for me. And that story is the story of a gay Jewish man from Liverpool who had a big dream. And those three factors of his personal life were huge obstacles. It was literally against the law to be gay. Anti-Semitism was rampant in the country, and Liverpool was a town that in the 1960s had no cultural influence whatsoever. So he was in many ways kind of the ultimate outsider, you know, running around Liverpool saying, I found a local band, and they're going to be bigger than Elvis. You know, people thought he was crazy. And while I definitely didn't have the kind of obstacles in my life that Brian had, I could still relate to that story very deeply. You know, I'm a first-generation American. My family's of Indian origin. And while I'm not the only one, you just don't see a lot of people of my ethnicity working in the spheres that I'm working in, graphic novels, film, television, Broadway, that sort of thing. And so it was his story was really very inspiring to me. And I know that's a very long-winded answer to your question, but I really did want to point out that it's more than just a great Beatles story. It really is a human story.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The book was incredibly moving, both in its telling of his story and in, I think, sort of the feeling of the atmosphere and times that you get from the art and from the writing in it as well.
Thank you.
I heard when you were speaking about the amount of exhaustive research that went into both the history and the visual history that's shown in the book. Your artist, who is the amazing Andrew C. Robinson. I mean, seriously, this is some of the best art I've seen in ages. Had said that, you know, you guys were trying to find the right image of the Cavern Club to use because there
right.
had been an older one. And if you want to talk a little bit about that process.
Yeah, you know, Andrew was a gift to this project. I mean, he's amazing. You know, you can look at the art, and his talent certainly speaks for itself. But even beyond that, he is incredibly meticulous in much the same way that I am with my, you know, my history and my research. He's the same way with his art. You know, he really wanted to capture the period properly in terms of architecture, wardrobe, facial expressions, you know, all of that sort of thing. So we really did do a tireless amount of research, photo references, clothing, you know, the whole bit, just to make sure either that we got it as perfect as possible or, quite frankly, you know, if we were going to do something that was technically incorrect, that there was a good storytelling reason to do that, you know, because we are those meticulous, crazy Beatles fans who would notice, and we were sure that there were others who would as well. and also just wanting to make sure that we could give the story all that it could be, to make it both beautiful and historically accurate, but also make it, you know, for lack of another word, a fun read, to make it a really enjoyable from a storytelling standpoint. That was also equally important to us. So we did work very, very hard on that. And I was very lucky to be working with an artist who cared about that, who really wanted to take the extra time to get that right.
Well, one of the things that folks hear me talk about on this show a lot is how much I hate when artists make everybody have the same face. And
right.
If there is one thing, right? Because clearly the only difference between me and anyone else is that my hair is red and theirs might be brown. But no, Andrew's art, he captures these people's faces so brilliantly and a whole range of expressions. And nobody has the same face shape as anybody else because in real life, nobody else has the same face shape as anybody else.
Yeah.
Except maybe your brother, But I love that you didn't – the look of each of the actual Beatles, they don't look the same as – the cartoon from back in the day, or from Yellow Submarine. It's a different look for them that you established for this, but it's completely obvious who's who in any frame at any moment.
Yeah, that we worked really hard on the facial expressions and the capturing the images of these folks who are icons and who have been portrayed as you've noted in the medium in many different ways over the years. There was the Beatles cartoons from the 1960s, there was the Yellow Submarine cartoons. They've been in comics before in varying degrees. And, we wanted to do something that was true to the way that they looked and to the history and the as I said, the photo references of it all, but also something that would kind of, tip its hat maybe a little bit in some ways to those past presentations, but also do something that was totally our own. And I don't want to put too many words in Andrew's mouth, but I think he would tell you that he worked really long and hard at that as well. And there were a number of early drafts where we didn't quite get it the way we wanted to, and we just kept working at it until we nailed it. So thank you for saying that we did, because it was something that was really important to us.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the costume, the clothes everyone's wearing is actually time appropriate. Yeah. People get so loosey-goosey and lazy about 60s stuff, it makes me really cranky. And then the color palettes you use for the different scenes are just wonderful. And I'm assuming that he did the colors. You didn't have anyone else doing that because it's all.
Yeah, most of Andrew's artwork for this book was actually fully painted. They were done on canvases.
Yeah.
And then scanned into Photoshop and then enhanced in certain areas, certain lighting and shadings. And he did do some computer enhancements, but for the most part, the artwork is canvas art. And it's interesting that you bring up color palette, because color palette was really the very first thing I thought about when putting this project together. People often ask me, why did I do this as a graphic novel? Why not another medium? And the truth, the answer is color palette. When I first started thinking about structuring the story, for whatever reason, it came into my head in a creative way in terms of color palette. It starts off in 1961 Liverpool, which in my mind was very dark, rainy, industrial, a little depressed. It was very black and white, or very muted and monotone, if you will. And then the story ends in 1967 London, which is the birth of the psychedelic era. We're literally entering the summer of love. It's a technicolor dream, as they say. So I thought of the arc of the Brian Epstein story as something that followed the arc of the movement of black and white to color. And I know that sounds awfully esoteric and poetic, but that's kind of how it came into my head when I thought about structuring it.
Yeah.
Thank you. And, those very color-oriented terms to me scream graphic novel and film. To me, those are the two most visual of the artistic mediums, and that's why we set about doing both. And we really did set about doing both, and the graphic novel just kind of took on a life of its own and has been completed first. But really, we were thinking about both from the very inception of the project. And so you'll see for those of you who've read the book and the rest of you, I hope you'll take a look. But you'll see we really did play around with that. It's not quite to the extent of moving from black and white to color, but those are the early pages of the book. You'll see Andrew uses blacks, whites, grays, blues. It's a very limited color palette. And then when you get to pages 10, 11, 12, Brian's at the Cavern Club. He sees the band for the first time, and we get a burst of color. You see our first oranges and reds and yellows. And then by the time we get towards the end of the book and to Kyle Baker's contributions, you know, we are in full-on Technicolor. And so we really did play around with that. And so it's really cool that you bring up color palette, because it was a really, really one of the first things we talked about was almost even before we talked about the specifics of the art, we talked about colors. So that's cool of you to pick that up. Thank you.
So kind of along with the color, and also something that you brought up before about making it fun read, I mean, Brian Epstein's life is very tragic because, you know, while he did these amazing things, he also had, you know, he was a closet. He couldn't be who he wanted to be due to the times and,
yeah,
you know, and everything. It could have been a very depressing tale.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. It could be very depressing.
Yeah, totally.
Somehow have managed to balance it so that, you know, by the end, you're as sad as it is, you're also filled with hope and there, you know, some joy out of it. You know, talk us through being able to balance all that and not just coming through like a sob story, which it could have easily been.
Yeah, you know, I guess that, you know, that part was something that was really important to me, but the way I kind of approach that is really just trying to tell the story in the way that it affected me. You know, the reason that I wanted to share this story with the world in the first place is because I find it to be all those things. I find his story incredibly inspiring, and while it is awfully tragic in many ways, I find a lot of joy and hope in the story. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I discovered it when I was a business student, and I was looking for inspiration in my life, and I found it both personally and professionally. I mean, the professional accomplishments kind of speak for themselves, but, you know, for this man who overcame all these obstacles, being gay and Jewish and from Liverpool and pursuing a field and a dream that people said, you know, people like you don't do this, you know. Mm-hmm. It sounds strange and to modern ears, but Jewish folks didn't work in the music industry in the 1960s in the UK. You know, it was run by Sir Lew Grade and, you know, old white Catholic Knights of the British Empire, you know, and so Brian had this big, beautiful, bold dream, and he chased it. And yes, there is a tragic side to the story, but he does realize that dream very spectacularly. And as a result, the world got the Beatles, who were a band whose entire message, you know, as cheesy as this may sound, was all about love. You know, lovely Rita, all you need is love, she loves you. I mean, that's what the band was all about. And Brian, you know, this one outsider's dream and his dogged pursuit of that, you know, brought the world a tremendous amount of love. I mean, that's how I look at it. And I find that incredibly inspiring and incredibly joyful. And while there is a tragic ending, it's also a story that left me full of hope, hope for my own life and my own pursuits, you know, in fields that are unusual for people like me, as they say. And so I really just wanted to put that into the story. To me, that's what this story is really all about. And I felt that if I could tell the story in the way that it affected me, if I could focus, you know, the history is important to me, and I really did spend 20 years kind of researching all the nuances of this story. But, like, I from the very beginning, I thought it's more important for me to nail the poetry behind his story than it is to get all the details and the facts right, although those are important, and we talked about that, and we spent a lot of time on that. You know, it's the poetry that really was more important. If there was ever a moment where I was worried about balance, I would say, let's go with the poetry first, and then we'll figure the details out later. You know, we'll make sure that the details fit. Because at the end of the day, the details, I wouldn't say they're easy, because some of that research was very painstaking and hard to do, but it's there. It's there if you're willing to spend the time to track it down. The poetry is a lot harder to nail, you know, because that's very esoteric and it's very personal, you know, because that's how the poetry reads to me. And I felt if I could you know, maybe pass on a little bit of how the story inspired me, then I would get that balance right.
I guess
speaking of actually, the creation of the character Moxie as a literary device was really really interesting narrative convention, I guess. developed for the graphic novel. And I don't know if you want to talk about a bit about that idea and what role she plays.
Sure. You know, I don't want to give away too much because I do want people to read the book, but there is a character called Moxie, and she is fictional in the sense that there was not, you know, it's not hard to do a little bit of research and realize that there was no Moxie who worked for Brian in the 1960s. However, everything that she does is based on something that one of four real-life assistants did. She is most closely based on Joanne Peterson's life. Joanne was Joanne Newfield back in the 60s. She now has the last name Peterson. And she is very much alive and vibrant and wonderful. She lives in Australia, has been a great friend to me and to this book, and an incredible resource and reference and inspiration to us. And she was the young female assistant that got swept up in the magic of everything that was going on and really looked up to Brian and had a crush on him and, you know, knew that he was, you know, her boss and gay and not someone that she, for a number of reasons, you know, chased or pursued, but, you know, she looked up to him as somebody who was elegant and handsome and eloquent and accomplished, and she, you know, she had a sort of schoolgirl's sort of crush on him and you know, those are all the key elements of the Moxie character. But Moxie is also based on Wendy Hansen, who is another female assistant, and she's also based on Alistair Taylor, who is an assistant that was with Brian and was the person that first took him to the Cavern Club. And she's also based on Peter Brown, who is with Brian in large part towards the end of Brian's life and really worked very closely with the Beatles as well. So really you know, again, it's sort of, as I said, balancing kind of the poetry with the facts. Like, the facts are all pretty real. You know, everything that Moxie does for Brian is something that one of Brian's assistants did. But I thought that for the purposes of telling the story, sort of the poetry behind Moxie and kind of what she represents for Brian, and I'd like to not talk too much about that because, again, I don't want to give away too much of the book. You know, I think that really is, again, a little bit more about the poetry of the Brian Epstein story, and that's kind of sort of how we approach that character. I hope that made sense.
Yeah.
What I mean, you kind of talk about in the book of the book about a lot of the work that went into it. I mean, walk us through the access that you actually had, because it seems to be almost unprecedented, especially about, you know, Brian Epstein, who has had no book ever written about him. So, I mean, it's got to be a pretty interesting for a lot of the people, as they might have not really done that sort of stuff before you.
Yeah, you know, so a lot of the research done for this book was done through interviews. If only because I had no other options. You know, there were no books, there were none of these online resources, and so that was the only recourse I had was interviews. And essentially, what I did, you know, when I became fascinated with the story, is I started reading every Beatles book that I could, or I shouldn't say every, you know, the ones that are noted as being most credible or most respected, or for, you know, for whatever number of reasons. So I would read all of those, and, you know, I'd read these 300-400 page books about the Beatles, and you'd get, you know, 10 or 15 good pages about Brian. But reading enough of those, I began to put a portrait together in my head of who were the people that really knew him the best, who he was closest to, folks like Joanne Peterson, who I mentioned earlier, also Nat Weiss, who was his best friend and closest confidant, and the Beatles' U.S. attorney, Sid Bernstein, who was the legendary concert promoter that brought the Beatles over to the United States and shared with Brian the Jewish cultural heritage, so they you know, sort of bonded over that. You know, there are a number of these folks, and really, I just, you know, found a way to contact them and got in touch with them. And this, again, was, you know, some 20 years ago. I was a student. I wasn't producing. I had no professional career or resume to speak of. And I mostly just said, hey, I'm a young guy looking for inspiration, and Brian's life has been inspiring to me, and I'm having a hard time really understanding it or putting all the pieces together, and I'm really just looking to learn more about this guy. And probably unsurprisingly, most of them were at first a little wary of, like, who is this kid and, you know, what's this all about? But, you know, after talking to me once or meeting with me once or twice, you know, after a couple initial initial meetings or conversations, I think they realized pretty quickly that I was very genuine, that my heart's in the right place, and this really is something that I care deeply about and I'm genuinely passionate about. And then, you know, over the years, they started to open up to me, and were very, and at the end of the process, were all very warm and welcoming and very flowing with their stories about Brian. And, you know, most of the folks that I interview, I'm proud to say I can now call my friends. And it really was a process. It really, you know, it was something that you know, that I got deeper and deeper into over the course of the past 20 years, you know. You know, at first I wasn't writing screenplays or graphic novels or anything like that. I was just looking for inspiration. So it was about, you know, somewhere around 6 to 8 years ago that I, you know, went back to all these folks and I said, okay, now I want to actually do something with this knowledge that I've accumulated. I want to actually tell the story in graphic novel form and as a film. And I'm happy to say at that point they all said, that's great, and, you know, we'd love to help. Let us know what you need from us. And, you know, so then we would do, you know, another round of interviews and got deeper into the stories. But that's kind of how it developed. So it was, and I think that was important because it was very organic. You know, it wasn't as though I initially called these people and said, hi, I'm Vivek Tiwari, and I'm writing a graphic novel about Brian, and I'd like to talk to you, and I have these 10 questions I'd like you to answer. You know, it was something that more started very organically, very from a place of passion and from the heart. And very slowly, I mean really very slowly, I became close with these folks, and slowly they began to trust me and open up to me. And it, I, to be honest, it really was in the past, you know, 5 to 10 years that I really felt that I started getting the full picture. And I think that's because these folks, A, started to trust me more, and B, I think the timing is better in the sense that, you know, once upon a, you know, Brian was gay, as I said, and in the 1960s, if they talked about Brian's homosexuality, it could have gotten their friend thrown in jail, so they certainly wouldn't talk about it then. And then, you know, after he died and the laws were repealed, it may no longer have been illegal, but it was certainly not socially acceptable all of a sudden, so they still were reticent to talk about it. And, you know, while today we still have a long way to go, we've also come a long way, and I think, you know, the general public is much more willing to, you know, to hear stories about gay men and the things that they've done without immediately having a negative connotation to the story because of the person's sexuality. You know, I think that's a real sea change, especially from some of these folks who are remembering a time when, you know, the mere intimation about it could have gotten you thrown in prison. So I think, you know, in some ways the time was right to tell the story. And then the last component is a lot of these folks are just getting older. You know, I mentioned Nat Weiss and Sid Bernstein, and, you know, they were both New Yorkers, and I'm very proud and happy to say that they became very good friends of mine. And sadly, the reason I'm talking about them in the past tense is that they died just a few months ago. You know, and I think that was another thing. I think they, you know, I this isn't something that either of them told me, but I really got the impression that they both kind of realized that they were getting older and they were, you know, getting, you know, sick, and if only because they were old and their time was coming, I think they realized that if they didn't, you know, impart their knowledge about Brian soon, it would get lost in time. So I think, you know, there were a number of reasons why these people sort of decided to open up to me, but the interviews and direct access to these people was critical to the success of the Brian Epstein story as told through the Fifth Beatle. I mean, I would never have been able to have done it, told it the way we did without, you know, very personal firsthand accounts of Brian and his life and times.
So, I mean, it's been a really long project. I mean, going on for, you know, 20 years. And your career has gone through many changes. I mean, you, for folks who don't know, I mean, you are a Tony Award-winning producer, you know, Raisin and Son, American Idiot, we actually get to go see next year, and I'm so looking forward to it. Addis
awesome.
Family.
Thank
like,
you.
Yeah, so many others. I mean, you yourself have found success in, you know, in music, in an offshoot of music with musicals.
Yeah.
And plays. You know, how did that impact the way you looked on Brian Epstein's life and might have shaped how the project came about?
Well, you know, it's funny. I've never really quite thought of it that way, but you know, now that you sort of frame it like that, you know, Brian took a band that really on the surface were four young guys making music, and he really saw in them something much bigger than that. You know, I sort of touched on this a little bit earlier, but I think he saw in the Beatles a group that had a great message of love to share with the world, and he thought that was a universal message and an important message and one that was worth chasing and telling and one that could be heard by the entire world if sort of packaged and presented properly, which is something he thought he could do. He could find a way to help them spread that message in a way that the world would listen and the world would hear and take notice. And it's not exactly the same thing, but in some ways, you know, what I've tried to do with my career is take my passion for music and expand that into a number of other artistic disciplines. You know, I did initially in my career work very deeply in the traditional music industry, and part of why I started my sort of academic pursuit studying Brian is I wanted to start by managing bands, which I did do for a period of time, and I left the traditional music industry. I loved it, but, you know, to be honest, I had a very hard time with it. The music industry is a very troubled place, and while I was very proud of the work I did in the music industry, we never had a significant hit, as they say. And so I sort of needed to scale back my artist management, my record label services, the kind of traditional music pursuits I was doing. But loving music as I did and believing that the pursuit of you know, working in the field of music was a worthy one, you know, I wanted to find ways of applying that passion to other mediums. You know, I wasn't able to successfully manage a punk rock band, but I was able to, you know, take a Green Day album that inspired me and put it on a Broadway stage, and that became American Idiot, you know. And music has really followed me in my entire career, in some surprising ways. You know, when I was producing A Raisin in the Sun, which is a non-musical, you know, it's a very straight play, classic piece of African-American literature. And, you know, we cast Sean Combs. We cast P. Diddy as the male lead. And you know, that certainly utilized my music contacts to make that happen. And when we went about, you know, marketing the project, we marketed it in a lot of ways the way one markets a hip-hop record as opposed to the way you promote a Broadway show. And that, paid off in spades for us. And so, you know, I definitely, you know, not unlike Brian, I found a lot of creative and passionate ways to apply my love of music and in pushing the boundaries of what might be considered typical music industry efforts, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Actually, one of the things I want to make sure we talk about is something that was really exciting, is your book's connection with the Freedom to Marry. So I actually missed the very beginning of the session at Comic-Con, so I didn't get to hear what the relationship was between the book projects and the nonprofit Freedom to Marry. So I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we have a relationship with the marriage equality organization Freedom to Marry that are at the forefront of that issue of securing marriage equality for people of any sexual orientation. And it's an organization that would really have made an incredible impact on Brian's life. Certainly was not something I think he really could have envisioned possible in the 1960s. You know, there was it's in the book, he does a television interview, and he's asked, you know, by a bunch of fans to reveal, you know, information about the Beatles' love lives. And somebody asks whether it's true that whether John Lennon was actually married. And he says, I think Beatles ought never to be married, but they will be one day. And maybe someday I will too. And people sort of laughed and kind of brushed it off a little bit and, you know, thought it was a joke. But, you know, for people who really knew him, for his inner circle who knew that he was gay, you know, that, and Brian always picked his words very carefully, you know, it was a pretty bold and visionary and sad thing that he was saying, you know, because I don't think he really thought that would be possible, but he was kind of saying that this is a dream worth fighting for, you know, maybe one day I could be. And that really is what Freedom to Marry is all about, is realizing that other very bold dream. You know, I often will say that, you know, Brian's his crazy visionary quote that he's most remembered for is you know, the Beatles are going to be bigger than Elvis. But the one that I think is actually sort of more even bolder and more inspiring and maybe a little sad and tragic because he died at the age of 32 is that comment about maybe one day I'll be married too. And that's what Freedom to Marry is all about. And so it seemed fitting to pursue a relationship with that organization tied to the book. And so, you know, at the end of the book, there's a page that highlights the good work that they're doing and explains how somebody can get more involved and just understanding the issues surrounding the marriage equality fight. And I will hasten to add that Freedom to Marry is an organization that I have actually had a very long history with. When my wife and I got married, next year will be 9 years, so longer than I've been working on the graphic novel. You know, we at our wedding, we made a toast to Freedom to Marry, and we made a large donation to Freedom to Marry, so they were very tied in to our wedding. And it was a very important cause for us because, you know, when we were engaged and we were planning our wedding, we were very, very happy, as many new, you know, newly engaged folks are. But it was also very difficult for us because we had a lot of friends who were gay, and many of them had been together longer than we had. And, you know, so we realized that, you know, while we were, you know, planning to celebrate our love by getting married, there were a lot of our friends who were being told that they couldn't because it was against law. And that was really hard for us to reconcile that. And so we wanted to get involved in that fight, if you will. You know, and I do like mentioning that because I think the connection to Freedom to Marry is wonderful, and it's good for the book, and, you know, it's wonderful that the gay community is embracing our book, and that's good for our marketing, and hopefully that'll sell books, and there are all those reasons, and sure, that obviously those are things that I care about, but that's not why we forged this relationship. We forged this relationship because it is actually a cause that's very near and dear to my heart. I suspect it's a cause that for a number of reasons would have been very near and dear to Brian's heart, and that certainly would have made a huge impact on his life. And, you know, while I don't think of the Brian Epstein story as an activist story per se, you know, as I've said a number of times in our chat tonight, I think the word inspiring has probably come up a number of times. I do feel it's a very inspiring story. So I do hope that people will leave the book inspired and wanting to do something, wanting to put that inspiration somewhere. And so, you know, we've highlighted Freedom to Marry as one place where hopefully you could put that inspiration. So, again, I don't think of it necessarily as an activist work, but I do hope that it'll inspire people to want to make a change in the world. And by highlighting Freedom to Marry, I hope we're giving our readers, you know, one easy and worthy cause to get in, one cause that's worthy and easy to get involved in and support, and one that has a natural tie to the Brian Epstein story.
Yeah. Well, I definitely think that, you know, every time that folks who are talking about comics or any other kind of art form are also talking about political issues and things like that, it's good for both parties, you know. It's good for comics people to have these conversations around them, and it's also good for the activists to follow us about the issues, to hear about our comics interests as well. So I always feel like, you know, I have some people who follow me for comic stuff and some people who follow me for labor union stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Get something out of both of those things, you know.
I totally agree with you.
The Freedom of the Married also kind of almost a theme of the Beatles. I brought up earlier is like so many of their songs about love and openness and caring, you know, no matter what. I mean, it's not just the Brian Epstein story. It seems to be a theme of the Beatles, period.
Totally. And, you know, we were very fortunate to get Howard Cruise to write a little piece for the Fifth Beatle about our relationship with Freedom to Marry that's in the book as well. And, you know, Howard is a dear friend, but he's also a bit of an idol of mine. I think Stuck Rubber Baby is one of the great graphic novels of all time. And so it was also just a real thrill to be able to have a contribution from Howard and to work with him a little bit on the Fifth Beatle.
Oh, and as a Stones fan, I have to say, the Andrew Lou Goldham introduction in the beginning was a lot of fun to see.
Yeah, totally. That was a great honor for me to be able to work with Andrew, somebody who really was there and really knew Brian so deeply and really knew Brian both on a personal level and certainly on a professional level, obviously managing the Stones, you know, Brian managing the Beatles. They were very much in the same world. So so being able to work with Andrew that was a real dream come true. It was a real honor.
Actually, speaking of which, I had the whole anecdote with Brian meeting with Colonel Lace's
Colonel
mother,
Parker,
I forget his last name. Thank you. Yes, the whole meeting with them. Of course that happened, but it's not, of course, it's also a story I never heard of before. How did you find out about that?
Yeah, so it is documented that Brian and Parker had that breakfast, and it's definitely also part of the research that's been documented that Brian very much hoped that he would find a friend in Colonel Parker and find somebody. It's heartbreaking. I mean, for those of you who've read the book, he could not have been more wrong in that hope when it came to Colonel Parker.
And anyone who knows anything about Parker's management of Elvis, now would anticipate that,
which is why
I don't think they counted as a spoiler.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Brian also hoped that he would find somebody that he could relate to and that would share the same dreams and style that he had. And, and as you said, anyone who knows these days anything about how Parker managed Elvis, he famously called Elvis an attraction. Parker, to give Parker his credit, he really did, in many ways discover Elvis and brought him his early successes. So there's no question that Parker was also a bit of a visionary, but the man was crude and did not have a very benevolent style of management, to say the least. So he was coming from a very different place than Brian Epstein. And so it is a matter of record that Brian had that breakfast with him, that he had high hopes for it, and he did also, report to his friends afterwards that he was very disappointed and disillusioned by Parker and by Parker's style and attitude towards Elvis. Outside of that, what was actually said in that breakfast and what actually happened, no one really knows. The two people that were there are obviously no longer with us. However, I will say most of what I've written in that sequence are actual quotes of things that Parker or Brian actually said, which is shocking because there's a lot of crazy stuff in that sequence. But Parker really did say, I warned Elvis about Los Angeles and New York. There are too many Jews in those cities, and Jews are going to take advantage of you. He did say, I don't take 50% of what Elvis earns. Elvis takes 50% of what I earn. It's all of that stuff is literal Colonel Parker quotes. I mean, the way I look at it as a writer, you just can't make that stuff up, that stuff is stranger than fiction, So that sequence, even though it is a lot of the presentation and some of the structuring of the dialogue is my creation as a writer, the content is actually surprisingly called from real life and from the other interviews and quotes and whatnot. Again, I don't want to give away too much for people who haven't read the book, but we also had a lot of fun with the art in that sequence. I thought of Colonel Parker as being somebody who is very vampiric in his treatment of Elvis, and so we said, let's slowly turn Colonel Parker into a vampire, and that's a little bit of what Andrew did in that sequence. My note, one fun story for the comic geeks in the audience is, one of the notes that I gave Andrew is, let's try to draw Colonel Parker like like a Ben Temple Smith vampire. And I think you can sort of see that in some of the panels. And I had the great fortune of meeting Ben at Heroes, at the Heroes Con this year. And it turned out he hadn't heard of the Fifth Beatle and was also eagerly anticipating it. And I had an early copy with him. And I was like, I want to show you the sequence. And he was very excited and pleased to see Andrew Robinson channeling Ben Temple Smith in a Colonel Parker vampire. It's just sort of a crazy thing all the way around, but we all were able to share a drink over that, and it was that moment, if I can be just a fanboy geek for a second, was a real dream come true for me, because I'm a huge fan of Andrew's, obviously, but I'm also a huge fan of Ben's, and that was a really cool moment for me.
And Temple Smith is the best-dressed guy in comics. I declare that all the time.
He sure is. He sure is. Maybe that's another reason why he can appreciate the Brian Epstein story, because they are both well-dressed men and can wear a suit with style.
We joke that he should be working in a fashion industry and doing a fashion magazine instead, but not to get too far off. So I actually have a question about that scene. So you've got, with the Parker scene and his treatment of Elvis and what he was saying, I mean, it was so, he looked at Elvis as a property and not as a person or talent or anything. And then you've got Brian and how he interacts with the Beatles, especially, and I don't want to give it away, one scene where he melts down because he thinks he's failed the Beatles and hasn't done enough for them or could have done more. Is that a scene that actually happened? Like, was that something that he really fretted about? And I just call it a meltdown is what it seemed like me to the reading it.
Yeah. I mean, that is all based in reality. He really did love the Beatles, I think that part of the way he loved the band was very paternal, even though he wasn't terribly far away from them in age. I think as a gay man in the 1960s, I don't think he ever expected that he would have children. And in a lot of ways, I think that, the Beatles were like, one part of his feelings towards them were they were like the children he would never have. And, for those of you who are parents, you'll know that you'll do anything for your kids and you dream big dreams for your kids. I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old and I'll do anything for them. And nothing will ever be good enough. I want them to have everything the world can bring them. And I think that was part of how Brian felt about the Beatles. He really did love them and really did believe that apart from his love for them, that they had an important message to share with the world and through the Beatles in some vicarious way, this was his opportunity as a gay Jewish man living in the UK in the 1960s, this was his way to spread a great deal of love in the world. For a guy that had to use a Beatles reference, hide his own love away, this was his chance to spread that love. And when he felt that he was failing in that, it was akin to a meltdown. I think it really was that important to him.
You said earlier that this was being done as not just a graphic novel, but also the movie from the beginning. Yeah. How do you go about creating both at the same time?
Well, we did really, plan both from the very beginning, and we did sort of, start to think about, what would work on the page and what would work on the screen, because there are, there are two very different mediums, and, when I adapted the graphic novel script into a screenplay, I didn't just, reformat it and otherwise think it was ready to go. The screenplay does have a number of sequences that aren't in the book and vice versa. But that being said, there was a period in the past where it did become very clear that the graphic novel was taking off and was taking on a life of its own and certainly was going to get done before the film. And so we really put our energies into that and into making the graphic novel the best that it could be and scaling back our film efforts for the time. And so as a result, the film really is far more influenced by the graphic novel than the other way around. Although, being very very anal about describing the history of this project, it may not be entirely accurate to say the film is an adaptation of the book. It's in some ways more an expansion of the book. So the book really was completed first, and then we did look to take the core of the book and figure out what works on screen and what doesn't. And, one of the very, very exciting pieces of news on the film is that we have access to Beatles music. It took me 2.5 years, but I did get the approval of AppleCore. Thank you. Yeah,
no,
it's unprecedented, actually.
Yeah.
What's that?
No one gets that. I was just telling it for folks who might not know. Nobody gets rights to Beatles music to use the actual songs. That's why you don't.
Yeah, I mean, we are literally the first and only film about the band ever to have gotten those approvals and to have had access to that catalog. So we're very, very proud of that. But you can imagine, so as a result of getting those rights, we're obviously going to use them. So there are a number of music sequences in the film that because film, has audio and there will makes perfect sense and would work beautifully. The book is not a book that can quite literally break out into song. And so while there are some music sequences in the book, it wouldn't make sense to have a great number of them. So there, that's one area that the film differs quite radically from the book. And there's also certain visual sequences in the book that I think make a lot of sense and look really beautiful in terms of Andrew's artwork that would be really out there to try to do in the film, in a film. So they really are two very separate mediums. But again, there's no question that that the film, you know, is greatly inspired by the graphic novel and will feel like an adaptation of the book, although I prefer to think of it as an expansion because we really, really did think of both in the early days. And it's always important for me to say that because I feel like these days, you know, there is a lot of film graphic novel crossover, and I feel like a lot of people make graphic novels because what they really want to do is make a film, and they think like, oh, if we make a graphic novel, we'll be able to sell that to a studio, and then we'll get the film we wanted to make. And that was never our intention. You know, I personally feel if that's your purpose for making a graphic novel, then the book is doomed from the beginning, because the mediums really, they do share a lot in common, but they are, you know, inherently very, very different as well. So it is important for me to say that the two projects were envisioned from the beginning, and they are very different.
Did their seeing the graphic novel help you get the music rights? Because, I mean, this really is an unheard of thing for people who don't know.
I'm not sure that it did because, you know, they kind of came together at the same time. You know, they certainly had to sign off on the script. So you know, they knew how I was telling the story, but the book wasn't done when I secured the music rights. The book was getting there, but it wasn't quite there yet. But they were able to see the script and see some of Andrew's artwork. So they were able, I think, to tell kind of how we were telling it, and I think they could see the passion and the sincerity behind how we were telling it. And at the end of the day, this isn't the Beatles story. It is Brian's story. And I think and this isn't something they told me, this is just my impression, that part of why we got those rights is because the band really loves Brian. And I think they also see that Brian's story has not been told and he's due. His legacy is worthy of attention that it hasn't gotten. And I think that was also part of, again, that's not something I was told specifically, but my impression is that that's one of the reasons why we were able to get those rights where others haven't.
Have you had an actual discussion with any, you know, surviving members of the Beatles and gotten their reaction to reading the book? If they've read it?
I can't talk too much about that right yet at this stage, but I will say that Paul McCartney in particular has been a big fan of this book. We were able to announce that at New York Comic Con. Dave Marsh, who was moderating the panel, had actually interviewed Paul earlier that week when Paul was doing promotions for his new album. And we hand-delivered a copy of the book to him, and he has read it and loved it and wrote us a very nice note about it. He happens to also be a comic book fan, so he really got it on a deep level. We're very, very proud of the fact that we describe him as a silent supporter. You know, he's not sort of officially or publicly endorsed the book, but he has told us how much he loved it, and he did write us a very lovely note. We're really very proud of that.
All this stuff you've had, because you've had amazing access to Beatles history. I mean, you're a Beatles fan. Like, what's the biggest thing that you've geeked out over?
What's the biggest part of the research process?
Out of all the things that you've come across or being able to check out or people you've talked to, doing all your research. As a Beatles fan, like, what really got you excited where you sat there and you're like, I can't believe I'm doing this or holding this or reading this?
You know, I mean, I am a huge Beatles fan. You know, my parents love the Beatles, and you know, ever since I suspect they were probably playing the Beatles when I was in the womb, so I've probably been listening to the Beatles since even, you know, before I was even technically born. So I really do love the Beatles, and I'm a hardcore fan. But I, you know, this is the Brian Epstein story, you know, and I describe Brian as my historical mentor. You know, I pick those words very carefully because I'm not a Brian Epstein fan. I think fandom implies a certain degree of unconditional love, which is important and has a place. And as I said, I am a fan of the Beatles. But Brian is someone whose life I've looked to learn from kind of both what to do and what not to do. You know, I think that there were, you know, he had obstacles, as I said, that I didn't have, but I don't have. But, you know, I think that he could have made more time for the love that was surrounding him. I think at times he worked too hard, and you mentioned the meltdown sequence, and that's a moment where, you know, if he could have had the forethought to take that step back and celebrate his accomplishments and realize how much he had done for them already, you know, maybe loved himself a little bit more in moments like that. Yeah. It would have been easier on his life. Anyway, so that's a preface of just saying, like, you know, kind of what Brian Epstein means to me. So the moments that I had in this process, they weren't even so much the geeky Beatles moments. I mean, receiving a note from Paul McCartney about, you know, the fact that he loved my book was obviously an amazing experience. It was one of those incredible moments that I'll never forget my entire life. But the real moments were with people like Matt Weiss, you know, telling me stories about Brian that he had never told anybody. Matt gave me as a gift one of Brian Epstein's business cards. He put it in a little frame and gave it to me. And you know, A, just to have one of Brian's business cards, and B, to know that the reason I got one was that it was a gift from his best friend, you know, that was an amazing moment for me. Again, I don't want to give away too much of the story, but there's a blackmail sequence that Nat helps Brian through, and Nat showed me the blackmail letter, you know.
Oh, my God.
And I believe I'm probably one of, you know, I don't know how, maybe five people in the entire world that have ever seen this thing. And that's a Brian Epstein moment, but it was moments like that that I realized, like, wow, I am really getting close to my mentor here, and I'm learning, and I'm loving, and I'm lucky, you know. And I think that was, if I had to pick one moment, it would probably have been that one. And it's not Beatles related; it's Brian related. But that's what's important to me here.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I was just lamenting that so many of the things I'd like to be able to talk about would be spoilers, so I can't. So I'm hoping that. Maybe sometime after the book has been out for a while, and we can assume that all good comics fans have read it, because and I can ask the questions that I can't ask right now.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. You know, it's funny when you write a biography, you know, so much of it is based on facts, you know, so to some degree it's like, well, are there really spoilers? You know, it's like, because you can, but in this case, I think there really are, and it's partially because so much of this information is just not known. And partially it's because I've keep coming back to, I've tried to really convey a certain poetry behind Brian's life, and that's something that really isn't in fact, you know. I'll give one example and try not to be too much of a spoiler with it, but you know, there's a matador and a bullfighting motif that runs through the book, and it's probably not so much of a spoiler if you've seen the cover, because you know there's a Brian as a matador sort of on the right there, up smack on the cover of the book, and it's an image that flows through the entire story, and it's poetic, and it's something that as a writer I sort of made up, in the sense, you know, where you see it in the book and how Brian talks about it is in large part my writing and my dialogue. However, I didn't totally make it up. Brian was a huge fan of bullfighting. And he spoke very at length and very eloquently to his friends about bullfighting, about why he liked bullfighting. Brian was a pretty peaceful and loving guy, and a lot of his friends didn't understand, like, how could you like such a brutal, violent sport? And so he kind of explained that to them, and so I was able to talk to some of these people like Nat about, you know, why did Brian love bullfighting so much? So, you know, a lot of kind of what I put there is based on truth between both what Brian cared about and why he cared about it. But, you know, again, this isn't giving away too much, but, you know, when he first sees the band at the Cavern, there's a bullfighting vision. And did Brian have a bullfighting vision when he saw the band? I don't know, you know, but it seems to me like something that he may have. And certainly I don't think it's a stretch, you know, to see the theatricality of bullfighting as not so far off from the theatricality of what he brought to the Beatles. You look at those Sgt. Pepper's costumes, they're not that far off from a matador suit, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, so I think while I've tried to be poetic in a lot of ways, it is based on some degree of fact or a leap of faith that is based on something more than just, you know, my creative whimsy. But those are the are kind of things that, that I hope could be like spoilers. You know, I don't want to talk too much about that because I hope that's something that I bring to the Brian Epstein story that you're not going to find anywhere else. You're not going to find in any interview, in any book, in any conversation you have with anyone, because that's, I hope, is my contribution to the Brian Epstein story that you're not going to find anywhere other than the Fifth Beatle.
Yay.
Thanks.
For folks who want to learn more about the graphic novel, you know, where can they go online to check it out?
Thank you so much for asking. We do have a very robust website at fifthbeatle.com, which has lots of information about the book. It has breaking news on the film. We also are very active in social media, and Fifth Beatle is our handle is at Fifth Beatle, very simple. And I'm pretty active as well, and I'm at Vivek J. Tiwari. That's V-I-V-E-K-J-T-I-W-A-R-Y. And I do, as you can tell, this is a real labor of love for me. So I do I do tweet regularly about Fifth Beatle stuff. And the book is also, you know, very easy to pick up online at Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, or IndieBound. So I would say those are the key online places. And Facebook, certainly. Fifth Beatle has a very active Facebook page, and where there is a very robust discussion going on right now about who should potentially play Brian Epstein in the film. So if any of your listeners want to chime in there, we would love your thoughts, because that is our next big effort.
I'm available, Brian.
Wow.
What's that?
I said I'm
You're available.
Saying.
We'll keep it in mind. We'll keep it in mind.
I was surprised. Fans never get asked. You know, the fan opinion is always the last to get consulted with on anything that has any hope of being a reality. Since I have the opportunity, I would chime in to think it would be fantastic if it was actually a British guy, thank you, who was gay or bisexual.
Look, the reason we asked is because we care. I mean, they're the first people that we and you know, one thing I didn't mention that I would like, if you don't mind me to just quickly report, I'm very proud to announce. We announced it last week that Peyton Reed is going to be directing the film. Wonderful director. He directed Bring It On, Yes Man, The Breakup. He's fantastic. He really nails the concept of doing something that's fun and entertaining while simultaneously having a core of the human condition and the struggle for ambition and accomplishment and the desire to love and be loved and to love in the right way. These are all the kind of things that are the core of the Brian Epstein story. And Peyton is perfect, and he's as passionate about this story as I am, and I'm just so honored and humbled to be working with him. He's amazing. But right off the bat, like, he and I wanted to know what the fans thought. You know, our next big thing is going to be casting Brian, and we were like, this is not a fan club or an American Idol situation where people are allowed to vote. You know, at the end of the day, we need to do what we think is right. But we want to know what the fans think, and we're reading that. I'll tell you, I'm not just saying this to get people to give us a like or start following our Twitter. You know, I don't care about the numbers. I care about the quality of our community, and we read every single Facebook post. And we are keeping a list of who people think would be right. And again, at the end of the day, we're going to do what we think is best. And obviously, passion is important. We want to work with an actor who's passionate about the role. And so it's going to be more than just what the fans think. But the fan opinion is the one that's most important to us, and that's where we went first.
I was going to say, if you want to melt down the internet, cast Ben Affleck. I think that's the lesson of the year.
That's right. That's right.
Actually, I actually do have a question. It's like, how do you get a director? I mean, like, what type of, you know, how did you come on Peyton Reed to direct the movie?
Yeah, you know, it's due to the subject matter, you know, it's Beatles related. It's a really fascinating story. It's an untold story, and we have Beatles music rights, which obviously are unprecedented. So there's a lot of exciting elements for a director to play with. Perhaps it'll be unsurprising that we got a lot of really wonderful interest from a lot of great directors.
Yeah.
And before I brought, before you know, we announced a few months ago that Bruce Cohen is my co-producer on the project, and Bruce is amazing. Bruce won the Academy Award for producing American Beauty. He also produced Milk and Silver Linings Playbook, so he was nominated two other times. And he also produced Big Fish for Tim Burton. And for those of you who've read The Fifth Beatle and
Big
have seen
Fish
those movies, you'll get it. You know, the Fifth Beatle, the DNA of The Fifth Beatle is in all of those films. You know, we've got the sort of the whimsy of Big Fish and sort of those fantasy-type sequences. We have the, you know, sort of the gay rights issues of Milk and sort of the deep concept of family and the human condition and the struggles of films like American Beauty and Silver Linings Playbook. I mean, Bruce and his background are absolutely perfect for this film. And I'm just going to quote Bruce from something he said at a New York Comic Con panel when talking about Brian Epstein and The Fifth Beatle. He said, you know, I'm not from Liverpool, but I am gay and I am Jewish. You know, so the Brian Epstein story is also very personal for him. And Bruce, you know, unsurprisingly, you know, given his background and his accolades, you know, he knows all the great directors. And so, you know, so we cast a fairly wide net and we're very discerning. And, you know, I've been working on this project for so long and it is a labor of love. It's like a baby to me. And so if I'm going to turn my baby over to someone, you know, I want to make sure that they're the right guy or gal for it. And it really just boiled down to Peyton having the right vision and the right degree of passion and just seeing the story in the same way we saw it. And, I mean, he just really is the best guy for the job. I mean, that's really what it boiled down to. And we really did talk to a lot and considered everyone, British directors, non-British directors, female directors, male directors. You know, we looked at a lot of different types of directors, people whose style is radically different. You know, we really wanted to leave no stone unturned, and that is why I can really say Peyton is the best guy for this project, because we considered a lot of folks, and he's the man.
Cool. I mean, is there a rough date? We can wrap it up on this. Is there a rough date as when we might expect the film?
You know, I am hoping that the answer to that question will be 2015. With Peyton on board and with the reaction that we're getting from actors, we are very confident that we will be shooting this film next year in 2014. And if that is the case, I see no reason why the film can't be in theaters in 2015. So hopefully a couple of years away.
Cool. Well, I think I can speak for both. We're really psyched for having you on. It's been awesome having you. I really, really appreciate it. Fifth Beatle is absolutely amazing. Like, it's one of my favorite graphic novels of the year, and I'm not just kissing ass.
Thank you so much.
This is something that everybody should buy for their friends, their family who love the Beatles or who love comics art. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. You know, it really was a group effort. I mean, Andrew did some wonderful work, as we've talked about, and we didn't talk too much about Kyle Baker's contribution, but Kyle does this amazing sequence in the Philippines. It's just a 7-page sequence, but the book is so much the richer for it. You know, it pays homage to the old Beatles cartoons of the 1960s. And, you know, so much of this, as I said, was based on research and, you know, things that people told me. And, you know, basically where I'm going with all this is I really feel that this book is, you know, yes, I'm the writer, but it really is a family effort. You know, so many people's souls and passions and memories and efforts were put into this book that, you know, it's you know, I really hope this doesn't come out like I'm patting myself on the back when I say this, because it's not my intention. But, like, you know, I look at it sometimes, and it's one of my favorite books too. And I, you know, and I'm also like, I sometimes can't believe I had anything to do with it. You know, like, I know I'm the writer, but I'm like, gosh, did I have anything to do with this? Like, I can't believe that I was a part of this. This is so wonderful. You know, and certainly I'll just let me focus on the art for another second, like, because I can't paint to save my life. And just, you know, any time I look at Andrew or Kyle's work on this book, I literally, my heart skips a beat and I lose a breath. It literally is breathtaking to me. And I'm a fan too, you know, so it's, you know, this is why I'm, you know, I'm totally happy to talk to you at 11 o'clock in the evening in New York City, because I'll talk about this all night. You know, it's something that I'm just so passionate about. I'm so grateful to everyone like you guys who've read the book and enjoyed it, and I really am proud of it, and I hope that the rest of you listening will check it out if you haven't.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I have a feeling both of us could keep going as well, because, I mean, we're really, really digging it. So, yeah, absolutely, everyone should go out and grab this. It's a fantastic gift for the holidays, hint, hint. So Vivek, really, really appreciate it for coming on. Hopefully we'll be able to talk again in the future when we can actually talk about the spoiler stuff.
Thank you. I would be pleased to come back and talk again. And maybe we can also come back when I've got some more film news to report. And then we'll have some new details as well. That'd be great.
That'd be awesome. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Have a nice night.
Have a good evening. Yeah. You guys as well. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Speak soon. Bye.
Yep, bye.
Bye. Brett, I didn't get a chance to say when he was on the phone, but I just wanted to share briefly that when I was a little kid, I was such a big Beatles fan. My parents didn't tell me that John Lennon was dead until I was in first grade, at which point he'd been dead for like 5 years, I believe. It's pretty easy hiding news stories from like 2 or 3 year old children, you know. But I was so shocked when I found out he was dead because that meant we couldn't get married. I was like completely devastated by that.
I wasn't a Beatles fan until later, until probably college. And it just took me forever to even kind of put two and two together as to like when all that happened and whether or not I was alive. I don't know. It was like a complete dissociation. It was just what, the anniversary Saturday or Sunday?
Something
this weekend.
That.
I think you agree with me is that this is like should be on the buy list of everyone, and they should be handing it out as gifts, and it's awesome.
And yeah, absolutely. I'm still like I was just reading it before our interview today, and I'm just still like, oh, my heart aches. But yeah, what an amazing book.
Yeah. So cool. I mean, it was a great interview too. So I guess that probably should wrap up the episode. We'll just keep it focused on that and the awesomeness that is the Fifth Beatle. It wraps up another episode of Graphic Policy Radio. I want to thank our guest, Vivek Tiwari. You can get the Fifth Beatle in stores now. You can go absolutely, like right now, go on Amazon, go buy it. You will not be disappointed. You can always catch us every day at graphicpolicy.com and on social networks, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Pinterest, more, all at Graphic Policy. We keep it nice and simple and consistent. So thank you again for listening. I'm Brett.
And I'm Ilana.
And as the Beatles always said, all you need is love. So until next week.